This podcast is proudly brought to you by Infinity Media, incubating innovative businesses in the media industry.
Hi, I'm Gordon Muller. I'm the guru in the Doc and Guru podcast. Thanks for being with us. For those of you who don't know me, I've spent over 40 years in the media industry in South Africa and pretty much made it my home, my life, my passion. I have other passions, unfortunately, for my sins. I'm an Arsenal supporter and a Sharks supporter, so we're going to do pretty much everything on the show as it pertains to media, marketing, and money, but we don't take jokes about Arsenal or the Sharks.
I'm Doug Mateus, the doc on the show. And again, for those of you who don't know me, I spent 30 years in various companies in South Africa running different marketing functions. And the last job I had, I was privileged enough to work with a team that took the brand to the fastest growing brand in South Africa in 2018 with a 47% year-on-year growth. So that was a great achievement for the team, and I'm really proud of that. From a personal point of view, I do a little bit of cycling and also snow skiing, so we quite enjoy that. But again, today's discussion is around all things marketing and media.
Yep, that's right, Doc. All things marketing and media. No subject too big, no topic too small, no subject too hot to handle. Please get in touch with us on our Facebook page, follow us, like us, whatever it takes. We would love you to be involved with the show, and we really want to make it as inclusive and as energetic as I know this industry is capable of. Morning, Doc. Welcome back from your trip to New York. We'll talk about that a little later on. I'm sure that was really exciting. And I see you're a bit reluctant to hug me this morning. We didn't have our normal greeting.
Yeah, Gordon, you one's got to be careful. But yeah, thanks. The trip was good. The flight's always long. And I've got to be honest, I was awake at 2 this morning, battling to get in the time zones. But yeah, we're all back.
And also welcome to Kelvin Watt, who is the Managing Director of Africa and Asia Nielsen Sports. Had a long history in the industry, and you've been doing some traveling as well. So I see you didn't hug me either. I'm the common denominator here. This is a bit problematic.
Just unhuggable, Gordon. Nice to see you again, and Doug, you as well. Great to see you both.
Kelvin, just to get going, I mean, you know, for many, many years now, I mean, Nielsen Sports has been the repository of so much learning with respect to sport and the extracting the commercial value of sport. I know you've been dabbling around the world. I mean, just start off, you know, what's the general climate like with respect to sponsorship in the sports area? I mean, is it growing? Is it gathering momentum? Is it kind of like the chewing gum proverbial on the end of the bed that's lost its flavor overnight? Where are we on a global scale, and then in South Africa specifically?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think right now in the world, South Africa is definitely in a very different place to the rest of the world. Certainly in a lot of the markets that I deal with, primarily, obviously Asia is the biggest one that sits under my ambit, but also with respect to my colleagues looking after Western Europe and the United States, sports sponsorship and the business of sport and sponsorship is as big and growing as it's ever been. And in fact, we're seeing record deals all the time, broadcast rights at the top end, really continuing to grow across a number of markets. That being said, South Africa has been in a very tough space, and I think that's a consequence of a number of things. The South African economy and some of the political upheaval that we've had in this country that's, you know, getting into an extended period of time. And unfortunately, the sports industry often sort of breeds off that sort of momentum of an economy and where people are, you know, mentally at any stage. So I think it's suffered from that, both, you know, of those two aspects. But the other thing that's really starting to hurt us from a South African perspective and where we're starting to fall behind the rest of the world, I guess, is tourism. The number one is just we're just not hosting enough big events. The sports industry is about big events, and it's what I call it's almost those big events that give an oxygen to an industry. So the biggest market from our business currently is Japan. And what we've seen in Japan over the last 4 years and the oxygen that was created for the sports industry, first through the Rugby World Cup and now going into the Olympics, has been quite extraordinary. And just, you know, what that's done, both from a broadcast perspective, what it's done from sponsors getting involved, new industries getting involved, people getting employed and getting into the industry, etc. It's just been exceptional in our Japan environment. And what we've seen off the back of it, for example, is a lot of the Japanese brands really starting to export their sponsorship investment as well. So we're really starting to see a much bigger interest from people like Toyota, for example, in global sponsorship. They now sponsor 144 properties globally around the world, for example. And that's really grown off the last 5-6 years as they've seen what sponsorship can do for them in their own backyard. And similarly with brands like Nikon and Fujitsu, we're starting to see become major global players. And off the back of that in China as well, you know, we've seen similar things coming off as people now really start gearing up for 2022 for the Beijing Winter Olympics and some of the other growth and what's gone on in the Chinese market. We're starting to see big Chinese brands like Huawei, Vivo, Hisense, Oppo, all starting to get really seriously interested in global sponsorship opportunities.
Well, Kelvin, that's amazing. 144 different sporting codes, areas for Toyota on a global scale. How do you manage that? Or is that just kind of baseball in America, rugby in South Africa, and whatever's the flavor of the country?
Absolutely. I mean, Toyota very much taken a decentralized approach. That's not necessarily the approach that everyone's taking. So we're seeing, for example, people like Hisense and Vivo taking a far more centralized controlling, and you know, maybe it's just from the Chinese culture. I think Toyota, for you know, have been part of the world for a long, long time as a business, and tend to have allowed a lot of their marketing to sort of devolve in a decentralized manner, as opposed to really sitting on it from a centralized manner in Japan. But obviously, within certain parameters, and very clear about what the objectives are for each market.
Doc, I know you've had a lot of experience on the client side from in sports sponsorship. I mean, what's your take on it? I mean, is it improving? Is it a better way to extract value than it used to be, or less effective?
Gordon, I've always liked it as a part of the marketing mix. You know, I've always looked at it as a passion point, as a chance to talk to people in their leisure time, you know, and it's one of those opportunities that you don't force necessarily things down somebody's throat, but somebody chooses to engage with it. And I guess, you know, Kelvin, we'll talk about the changing consumer, you know, in terms of the different consumption patterns and how people are viewing their time. You know, it's a precious, I don't want to say a more precious commodity, but certainly people are looking at their watch and saying, do I want to allocate X time to this particular endeavor, whether it's watching an ad, which is sometimes quite irritating, or whether it's going to the field or watching it on TV or on demand for that matter. So I certainly have, and I continue to like sponsorship as part of the portfolio. I really believe it adds huge value.
Kelvin, I mean, you've obviously done a lot of research, so this is not just anecdotal stuff we're talking about here. And one of the phrases that you used in your presentations, which stuck with me, was hyper-competitive attention economy, apart from the fact that it's a lovely big phrase. I mean, What's that alluding to? What's the challenge implicit in that?
What it's really is about is just getting people's attention today is just extraordinarily difficult. And, you know, we have so much opportunity to, you know, I mean, Doug sort of talks about getting in touch with people during their leisure time. What sport and sponsorship is being able to do is get in touch with people during their work time, because people are never off. They're always on their social media. They're always on their phone. We're starting to see people spending 7 and 8 hours a day on their devices. Now, to be spending that sort of time, they're doing it while they're at work as well. And I think one of the beautiful things that sport specifically does, but, you know, certain other enterprises as well, and which allows sponsors to engage with people, is a lot of these mobile devices through artificial intelligence are actually learning, and they're pushing stuff to us. So, for example, if they see today that you have an interest in a minority sport like hockey, they'll be pushing you hockey content all the time across these different platforms. And I think that's the thing that really has fundamentally changed and has become even more powerful for sponsorship for brands, in that, you know, if they pick the right brands or if they pick the right sponsorship opportunities that give them the right opportunities to tell stories. And I think that for me is where the big changes come in the world of sponsorship, is the days of buying branding and exposure and tickets essentially in a package are really changing. And we're starting to see a huge drive in the big sponsors to looking at what storytelling opportunities are they being given? What content creation opportunities are they being given? And I think one of the big, you know, you asked me earlier about what's gone on from South Africa compared to what I'm seeing around the rest of the world, is South Africa is still very much stuck in branding on the jersey, you know, perimeter branding, some tickets, a little bit of hospitality thrown in, those sort of things. And what they're not getting, which we're seeing a lot of the big rights owners around the world, is working with their sponsors to create content. And, you know, we saw some really good stuff come out of Cricket South Africa maybe 4 or 5 years ago with Protea Fire campaign. It seems to have backed off a bit in the cricket context. We're seeing some good stuff in pockets like, you know, the Sharks. I'm starting to see some really interesting stuff in football with Orlando Pirates and Kaizer Chiefs, for example. But generally, our rights owners in this country just don't have the people working for them. They don't have the budgets in place to be creating great content with the brands, and those are the ones that are going to succeed and be successful.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned time online. I know from the digital consumer survey and the report which Nielsen published last year, not sports related, but the average digitally connected South African, and by which I mean anybody who's been online in the past month, spends 33 hours a week online. And if you go into what I called born freeze, but I think in your sports research, you're talking about Generation Z, same sort of thing.
Yep.
They're spending, 38, 40 hours a week online, and the vast bulk of that is the mobile device. So that's the key to a lot of this.
Absolutely. And, one of the things, that there's a lot of myths that Generation Z have lost interest, for example, in sport and stuff. And certainly they have lost interest in watching live sport in a linear television environment because it just doesn't do enough for them. It's not interactive enough for them. But if we see them in terms of the level of consumption of sport that they're interested in, but doing it through mobile, doing it through short format content and other, slightly different content formats, highlights and things like that, they're still massive users and are still really important sports fans of the day, are the most important sports fans of the future.
Yeah, the highlights component is crucial. I mean, and when you get deprived of your highlights, I mean, I was searching fervently this morning to watch the highlights of Liverpool going out of the European Cup last night, but I couldn't find them. I think there's a conspiracy not to put them on TV. But you also made mention in the research, and it's a global study, that millennials spend money on experiences rather than material possessions. So
yep.
A phrase which really resonated with me, I think it's brilliant, is the festivalization of sport. Why don't you unpack the implications of that for marketers? What does the festivalization of sport mean from a really, sponsorship perspective?
What it means is that when people are going to participate in live sporting events today, they're looking for so much more from the experience than literally just a seat with a good view and maybe an opportunity to buy a beer or a Coke or a relatively warm hamburger at halftime. They really are looking for something much more than that. And so, the people that are in the business of putting on live sporting events need to deliver a lot more if they're going to expect people to fill up their stadiums and various things like that. And, I think in a South African context, some of the things we do quite well, and we've probably done it for quite a long time without perhaps consciously doing it. And, the things that we see that tend to be fully subscribed, the Sevens down in Cape Town at the end of the year, the Pink Day at the Wanderers, for example, the Durban July and some of the sort of bigger races where there's a lot more to it than just the main race, the seventh race and things like that. It's a lot more about the food and drink experience, the music experience, the fashion, everything else that goes into making that a bigger event. And, around the world today, there's some just exceptional examples. The Australian Open is probably one of the best in that respect. The Melbourne's really got behind it, and they have about 2.5 million people who attend the Australian Open without going to the tennis. So literally there's a food, wine, music, everything else, festival going on around the whole periphery of that tennis. And over 2 million people just attend that during the 2 weeks, people who don't even go to the tennis.
Yeah, I must say, I had the pleasure of going to the Australian Open 2018. And as a tennis player in my youth, I'd always viewed the Australian Open as the lame dog of the majors until I actually got there and saw how gigantic that event is. It is incredible. The whole town literally comes to a standstill with fan zones and
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, Gordon, I think on that, that's exactly where it's gone. Just talking of tennis, I mean, Wimbledon's got the same. If you can't get tickets to the actual game, you can sit on the embankments outside, have the strawberries and cream, the champagne, the Pims, and be part of the whole thing. And I think that's exactly where it's gone. You look at MotoGP weekends, a Formula One Grand Prix.
Absolutely.
And also one of the things, and let's just maybe touch on it, is the rise and continued rise of esports. Now, I wasn't even aware that, and I think it's the Abu Dhabi, the last Grand Prix of the year,
yes,
they have a festival of gaming at the same time. And then I see a year or two ago under UEFA, they also brought through on the Champions League final game, they brought through esports where people would play on the at the same city, the same correct venue that they'd play. So it's a whole merging of esports, entertainment, what I would call real traditional sports festival, and all of it mixed together.
Absolutely. I mean, on top of that, that is the final weekend of F1, and they actually have the virtual F1 as well, which is the esports version of F1, as you said, takes place at Abu Dhabi. At the same time, they have massive music festivals going on around there and everything else. So it's all built into an entire 2-3 day packed agenda in Abu Dhabi each year. But we start to see that at most of the Grand Prix around the world this year. If you go to Formula One are doing a lot of the sort of trends that we're seeing in global sport right now, F1 is one of those organizations that's right at the forefront of it. The festivalization of the events, I think they've always been pretty good at, but they've extended it, like you say, into music festivals, into esports events and all sorts of things. You know, they're also doing an incredible job of the storytelling and the bit that I'm talking about. So, you know, the Drive to Survive, if any of you have watched that on Netflix, it's into its second season. It's probably the most extraordinary sport programming that you'll see. And I think it's going to fundamentally change the way that you see in terms of owners, the technical people behind the teams, the drivers themselves, how you get inside a sport and just what a program like that on Netflix is doing for the sport of Formula One, just growing the interest into the actual live broadcast and into the event is just exceptional. So F1 have really done an incredible job of that. Similarly, the NBA, they're doing a very similar thing with NBA Y2K and things like that, you know, with their basketball, the esports basketball version. So we start to see that out of the really big organized rights owners around the world are really fundamentally understanding that what they're offering is not necessary that, you know, 90 minutes or 80 minutes between the white lines, that, you know, they really got to provide a 7 day a week sort of full, you know, opportunity for fans to engage with them. And then when they bring them to those live events, they've got to be giving people something much more than they've ever experienced before. And the other thing that we're starting to see come around the world is a lot of what's starting to be used in terms of the live event distribute, you know, how a live event is put on for esports, people are looking and going, well, maybe we could learn from that. So for example, one of the things you see if you go to an esports live event, you'll have 20,000 people. While the esports is on, those people are almost not on their phone, which is quite extraordinary. Whereas at other sporting events, people are very much on their phones. They're very much engaged with what's going on the screen. But there's also live commentary going on for those 25,000 people. So can you imagine going, you know, we're talking into a Sharks rugby environment, you go into Johnson's King Park, and you've actually got a commentator talking you through the whole game, but he's vibing it up. He's getting behind what he's seeing on the field. And obviously, in an environment like that, it would be relatively biased towards the Sharks. And, you know, that's probably something that the average rugby viewer would probably could not get their head around. But the sort of the younger millennials and certainly the Generation Zs, it's something that they would expect going to a rugby event. When it's not there, they almost feel like it's something they would like to have there or are missing.
You're listening to The Doc and the Guru, proudly brought to you by Infinity Media.
And the generational thing is important for me as well. It's always kind of intrigued me to go to sport football games in England, for instance, which you have a reputation for being a bunch of yobbers, you know, looking for a fight. But when you actually go to a game, it's fathers and sons and grandfathers. That generational thing is there. How do you maintain that sort of generational commitment if it's all going to be kind of an e-based activity? We're talking, for instance, games that have been played in Europe last night with empty stadiums. I mean, that becomes passionless. At what point do you sacrifice passion for functionality?
Well, I don't think you can. I mean, I think in the perfect environment, you know, even in the esports environment, the best esports events are the ones that are packed with 20,000-25,000 spectators, and they're massively engaged in the content. So, you know, I think one of the things that you get at those British football games is this massively engaged audience that is partaking in everything that's taking place. You know, there's certain things that are problematic for live sport and they've got to start thinking about, you know. So one of the things, for example, our research is showing, and it's particularly prevalent in a South African context, and we could talk about South African fans and how we segment them here, and they're quite different to what we see around the rest of the world. But one of the big issues South Africans are starting to have, and especially younger fans, is they don't get the concept of sitting in a seat. You know, for them, they bought a ticket to the event and they should be able to roam the entire place. And if they're friends on the other side, they should be able to walk around there and stand and spend time with them. And certainly if they go to food festivals and other things, you know, you can float around the whole place. And so this idea of this is my seat and I must sit next to somebody I don't know and interact with an event, not necessarily from the seat that I want, is just a foreign concept to them and one that they're not willing to compromise on. They say, well, if you're not going to give that to me, then I'll go somewhere else for my live event experience. And so I think what we are going to see is just a redesign of stadiums. We've seen a little bit about that. We were talking earlier about Johnson's Kings Park. You know, there's a bit of a redesign of the stadium there. What's going on behind the post is now becoming on the one end, it's a beach bar, you know, sort of over 18s, under 30s type of fun environment. On the other, it's children and kids almost in a play area with water slides and everything else going on. But whilst the rugby's right there and they're sort of participating in both. And that's really where rights owners need to be thinking about the delivery of their events if they want to start getting the sort of numbers to come to every single event that you do get at a pink day at the Wanderers, for example, or at the Sevens Rugby in Cape Town.
Yeah, if you've ever been to a Chiefs and Pirates derby, the concept of actually having a seat has long as I'm not sure it was ever there.
And you know, again, it's yeah, extra strong, as they call it. Yeah, absolutely. You know, maybe it's consequent. I think there's certain things that, you know, people were perhaps a little bit ahead of their time, and it was perhaps just practically easier not to do it. You know, and we came 2010 and we all decided that, you know, if we're really going to get serious about football, everyone needs to, you know, get into a seat. But that's not really what people want from a live experience.
Yeah.
And they don't fundamentally understand that, you know, I've paid the same price as the guy in block D and I'm in block A, but he's my mate. I want to go and stand and watch the game with him, you know, so.
Yeah. And so that kind of leads us to the activation. For me, again, probably old-fashioned thinking, but I always viewed sponsorship as the brand in action. So I could understand the link between Castle sponsoring rugby. It was a natural. I could see the evidence of the brand in action every time I went to a game. But you know, you talk in some of your research as well about the challenge being, you know, balancing bundling players' rights versus channel versus the technology. How do you manage the multifaceted thing? So if you've got kids on one end of the stand, but it's being sponsored by an alcohol brand, how do you separate these two things and make sure everyone gets a fair stake of it, including the players themselves?
Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, one of the things that's really fundamentally changed, whether it's outside the activation outside the stadium or inside the stadium, is, you know, I think traditionally, one of the reasons that we saw the big beer sponsors so involved in sport and traditionally there was exactly that. The link was relatively easy to see and it was very easy for them to activate. Today, what technology is largely allowing is anybody, not just the beer brands, to get involved at sporting events and other entertainment events. So I think what we'll see coming through there is just this ability through different technologies for everyone to get their sort of piece of the action. And so much more of activation is going to move onto social digital platforms and other things. And so you might see, for example, areas on one end of the stadium being set up to do TikToks and things like that for a real Generation Z environment. And on the other, you could go to the sort of perhaps the most formal of rights, the real hospitality opportunity, the business-to-business opportunity for people to still go out there with their customers, all within one stadium environment. So, but the technology side is really the bit that's really fundamentally allowed people to change that experience. So, you know, I don't know how, if any of you, I'm sure you might have a listener or two who's a Tottenham Hotspur fan, but their new stadium environment is quite extraordinary. You know, they everything is built into their app, and so as a consumer, The app recognizes whether you're a local London ticket buyer or you're a Japanese fan who's coming to the stadium. And if you're a local Londoner, it knows where in London you come from. And it starts talking to you from the moment you're coming to a game and saying, this train, for example, there's an issue at the station. Or if you get off here, we're doing an activate, whatever it might be, a very tailored environment for you. And if you're a Japanese fan, it gives you a completely different communication that day. It knows you're coming to the ground because it's linked to your ticket. It knows where you're sitting. It says, look, you probably want to visit the stadium museum. You might want to go to the shop and buy this because you're a visitor. So right into the technology, it allows you to give every single person a completely different experience of the day through the app linked into their ticket. And that can be age thing, or it could be, you know, where you're from, what sort of fan you are, whether you're a regular fan, whether you're a first time visit to the stadium.
The nice thing about the Spurs app is that when you download the trophies, you don't use a lot of data. Doug, I mean, again, activation, this is your game. I just get to invest your money. But I mean, this is cutting edge marketing stuff for you.
Absolutely, Gordon. And I mean, I was speaking to someone a while ago and he was doing some work with the RFU in England, the Rugby Union, England Rugby Union. And he was saying he was amazed a few years ago to see a whole floor of people engaging in digital, where we were certainly years behind that, you know, and I think now we fast forward a few years. I can only imagine how that's gone on. And I mean, one of the points you were making earlier about Formula One, and I think, am I right to say it was after the Bernie Eccleston era, Formula One had become quite old.
Absolutely.
And suddenly, and with the new owners coming in, that injected new life, because I think part of the lesson was looking at MotoGP and saying, but hold on a second, this is a younger sport, it's more interactive, it's more vibey, and so it's quite encouraging that Formula One is now closed that gap and caught up, certainly.
Well, and not even caught up, they've gone past. I mean, quite right. I mean, you know, to give you a sense of that, up until the beginning of the 2019 season, I think, so as recently as just over a year ago, or maybe a little bit into 2018,
drivers weren't allowed in terms of to be on social media and to comment on what was going on. And now it's been now they've almost ramped up to the next level.
Yeah.
What we saw with Drive to Survive, their Netflix series last year, is that two of the teams, including Mercedes, refused to participate because they didn't want people coming behind the scenes. Mm. It was so successful. Mercedes-Benz were front of the queue this year to be involved and to make sure that Hamilton, I mean, he basically, you know, he just talks about anything and everything. I mean, it's just the most extraordinary access into the world champion that you've ever seen. So, absolutely, you know, they've really taken a fundamentally different view of their business. They built a massive social and digital media team. They've just completely rethought their sport.
Yeah, and it's but it is like it, and I think it's often I think that human intrigue factor that you can see 80 laps or 80 minutes or whatever, you know, but you don't always know what happened before and after. And I remember years ago when Robbie Hunter, the South African cyclist, was riding in the Tour, and we did a thing with him and we said, Robbie, send us pictures, not of the stage, because we could see that on TV, but before and after, you know, and it was huge, the intrigue factor, because people didn't know the food a cyclist would eat before the race, the massage afterwards, the team talk on the bus, etc. And I think, you know, it's just taken it to the next level. Come on, just in terms of stepping back into esports for a second, maybe if you don't mind, just talking about some of the sponsors, and again, you and I have had the benefit a few years ago of talking a little bit about that. And perhaps, Gordon, older, non-traditional sponsors, you know, so in other words, not Monster and not just Red Bull,
not the
and not just Snickers. Yep. Those I expect, much like the Castle of old, but other brands have come in to esports because they've seen and linked their brand to the rise of esports.
Absolutely. I mean, look, you know, I think esports, I mean, it's big. And you know, but let's not get too carried away by it. It's not big. It's not rugby and cricket and football big in a South African context, for example. It's certainly growing. One of the difficult things about it is that it's a hugely fragmented environment. So we talk about esports like it's one thing. It's not. It's like thousands of things all patched together that really makes it, you know, so it's extraordinarily fragmented in terms of its offering, which has made it very difficult for a lot of brands to fundamentally understand it, especially brands who don't live in that space. You know, the Monsters you talk about, or some of the, you know, the people that are in the speakers business or the IT, you know, the people who are endemically involved in esports. But certainly what we've started to see is a leap into esports by a lot of mainstream sponsors and advertisers that are starting to take it quite seriously. We certainly getting engaged. We've now built over the last 5-6 years an esports and games business that basically just concentrates in this particular area. And we started to see the Anheuser-Busch's, the Coca-Cola's, you know, some of those real old school sponsors getting involved, the Adidas's, the people like that. A lot of the motor manufacturers, for example, all starting to move into that space. DHL, for example, do some amazing work in the esports sponsorship space, you know, real business-to-business old school German, you know, rooted business, but really taking esports very, very seriously.
I think it seems to me that, you know, coming back to my little corner of the world, which is the media side of it, that the biggest losers here are traditional media. And again, referring to your research, which came out of North America, the ANA, the Northern American Advertising Association, where when it came to activation, that, you know, advertisers indicated that about 78% of them activated in social media, of which the mobile obviously was the biggest activation, 62%. Well, I was intrigued, the point that you raised earlier, hospitality, 79% of them are still looking at hospitality as the big point of activation, which you'd understand in terms of the festivalization. But the big loser is traditional advertising at 56%. So that old adage, for every rand you spend on a sponsorship, you should spend 5 promoting it in media, it seems to have imploded.
Well, I don't think it's imploded completely. I think what's fundamentally changed is that, you know, the one right that was relatively exciting to people was sort of a use of players and to create some content. You know, you talk about Castle Lager, some of those fantastic Castle Lager ads that were built around their cricket and rugby sponsorships. Effectively, it was one of the few ways that they had of activating outside of the stadium environment. What's changed is they fundamentally have so many other options to do that activation. And, you know, the most effective is not necessarily running a sort of a 30-second spot campaign built around, you know, a really, you know, iconic piece of music and some funny, you know, content of guys sitting painted white at the side screen or whatever it might have been, and things like that. You know, some of those great Castle ads of old. So, you know, social and digital media has really just allowed them to be in people's hands on a daily, hourly basis, activating their sponsorships. And I said one of the other things that's a big strength of social and digital is through AI, it actually starts to push content towards people who are interested, which television can't do. You know, it can have a look at a demographic and say, look, more than likely in this, and you can plan it, you know better than anyone. But what the social and digital media can start doing is it can literally start saying, you know, here's Calvin Watt, he's a Liverpool fan. I see him, you know, follow their tweets on Twitter. I can make sure that content is pushed to him. And, you know, if I'm a Standard and Chartered, you know, I can start making sure that he sees our content that we create and whatever it might be. And the more of their content that I engage with, the more time I spend on the app, the more they push to me. So these brands don't necessarily need to be making these big TV spots to activate their sponsorships anymore. There's a lot more effective ways to do that.
Okay, I think we want to wrap because there's a whole bunch of things which are cropping up in my head. One of the things I'm hoping to probe, but maybe that's for another session, is the gender kind of mix. I mean, you know, women's cricket. I've been watching the women's cricket in Australia and thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. In many respects, more entertaining than the male equivalent. But, you know, that's for later on maybe. You know, how do we decide who is worth X and who is worth Y when it comes to investments? But Calvin, thanks for coming in. I know you've got a busy global schedule. I really appreciate it. Doc, thank you for being here once again and giving us your marketing insights.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, Gordon. Thanks, Calvin. I think, you know, just touching on women's sport, Gordon, as a closing, and again, I just saw another article come out around the women's US soccer team. I mean, it's a huge court case and has been going on for a while. And I see massive sponsors now coming out against US soccer. Coca-Cola, Visa, Deloitte are saying, listen, you know, you've got to retract your statement in terms of saying that the skill level's different, the effort level's different, et cetera, you know, and we're talking about getting to some level of parity, because certainly, and I think Visa and Coke were very outspoken about their products are for everybody, and they don't discriminate on the basis of anything, you know. So I think that is, as you say, definitely a separate topic for another day, as is cause-related marketing, you know, Calvin. Absolutely. I mean, the world has gone and continued to do sport for good. You know, a lot of stuff. Absolutely. And maybe just one closing comment from you. And I know it's, again, such a big topic. Just in terms of your experience, the research from Nielsen, in terms of companies and brands associating and using the power of sport as an uplifter.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, and I think that's a big part of what we're seeing brands getting behind the women's sport environment. And certainly we're a big fan of it. We're starting to see some fantastic results coming out from women's sponsorship. One of the ones is this sort of idea of borrowed imagery and association. And there's really positive associations that come out with being involved with women's sport. You know, Gordon, you spoke about the cricket. We saw the same with the Women's Football World Cup last year, really successful. And the same thing from a cause perspective, you know. And one of the things I'm loving at the moment is the Sharks. I see color. They've gone and made a real big statement. And it's, you know, it might have been gone past this sort of, it's a controversial topic that a lot of us don't want to talk about, you know, this transformation of audiences and transformation of teams. And the Sharks have just hit it head on and said, we believe in diversity, we celebrate it, we love it. Mm. You know, and I think the sponsors, the fans, the players are getting behind it, the broadcasters are getting behind it. So I think there's massive power in sport standing for something. And I think one of the things in South African sport, we've sort of got quite political correct. We need to start standing for things again. You know, we saw it with Nike. Nike's just completely sort of re-established the brand as a brand that stands for something.
Yeah. Absolutely. And Gordon, you and I spoke on a previous podcast about the whole Colin Kaepernick thing. That certainly on day one, day two, day three, the thing just went south. You know, it was just so wild, so controversial. And when it turned, it just, you know, took Nike stock, you know, to new levels.
Absolutely. And, you know, what they did with Costa Semenya, you know, just massively positive stuff in the way they dealt with it. And it's been great for the brand.
100%. And I mean, just one shout out to Ed and the team at the Sharks, you know, well done. Because, you know, they really have, as you say, in a South African context, taking the issues head on in a very positive way, and not only on the park, but I mean certainly off the park and in the fan base, etc.
So, well, I think that's such an important thing. You know, if you're going to do something like they've done, you've got to live up to it. You know, and I think that's the other thing that the Sharks really are doing, is that they're living what they stand for.
Yeah.
Mm. Calvin, once again, thanks for coming in. Really appreciate it. And Doc, you can put your mask back on now. Unless I see you're gesticulating furiously. How you? Another comment coming.
I just want to know, Calvin, how can people get a hold of you? You know, from our point of view, Doc and Guru Podcast, it's all about inclusion and about dialogue. So please, if you're out there and you're listening to us and you like us on Facebook, get involved, send us your comments. But please also interact, Calvin, with you at Nielsen. How do people get a hold of you?
Probably the easiest is just via my email, calvin.watt@nielsen.com is the easiest.
Great.
Tend to always be available more on email than other things, depending on where I'm, where the travel's taking.
Yeah, sure. And again, thanks for that, because as we say, as you always say, get involved. It's a dialogue. We don't want to just be 30 minutes and it's a stop start. This is an ongoing dialogue, so please get involved. Gordon, from my side, thanks very much. I'll catch you next week.
Yeah, catch you next week. And it's goodbye from the Doc and the Guru.
And so that was another episode of The Doc and the Guru. Please don't forget to get a hold of us on Facebook, like us, follow us, subscribe to the podcast. And then from my side, you can get a hold of me on LinkedIn, Dr. Doug Mataz. I'm very active and very keen to hear about your views and certainly will respond. And hopefully we can bring that into the show.
Thanks, Doc. And it's Gordon Miller, the Guru, signing off. Thank you for being with us and listening into this podcast today. You can pick up the discussion with me on my Twitter handle, at Mzanzi Media. And I'd love to engage with you on any of the issues that we've taken on in the show. And take us at our word. This is really going to be an open forum. There are no subjects that are taboo. And we'd love to have some of the younger, more under-listened, if that's the correct phrase, voices to join us in this discussion. Thanks for your time.
The Doc and the Guru, proudly brought to you by Infinity Media, incubating innovative businesses in the media industry.